Morning, everyone. So I wasn't here for the Christmas celebration, and I was going to read some poems, and one of the poems I'm going to read is kind of suiting for this. I'm going to just read it real quick because this is warming up here. It's a kind of the kickoff to things. So this is London by William Blake. I wander through each chartered street near where the chartered Thames does flow, and mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe. In every cry of every man, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every bane, the mind-forged manacles I hear. How the chimney sweeper's cry every blackening church appalls, and the hapless soldier's sigh runs in blood down palace walls. But most through midnight streets, I hear how the youthful harlot's curse blasts the newborn infant's tear and blights with plagues the marriage hearse. So I will be presenting on this book, Capitalist Realism, Is There No Alternative? And I will be connecting it to the fifth principle. And there are, I have to bury the lead, because there are two main takeaways I had after reading this book and then looking over the fifth principle. So a bit of background here on Mark Fisher. This book was published in 2009, shortly after the financial crisis ended, by Zero Books. Mark Fisher was a English cultural theorist and educator, and he passed away at least 7 years ago this month. He committed suicide. He dealt with depression all his life. Just as a kind of a sad end to a really interesting man's life. And then there's also an essay he's very famous for called Exiting the Vampire Castle, which is just an interesting title for an essay. And it basically has to do with allowing individuals to have grace when maybe they don't deserve it, and how to basically form these friendships with the people and give people the benefit of the doubt when working towards a common goal. It's a very interesting, thought-provoking essay. And this is not going to be I was originally conceiving of this talk as a summarization of each chapter of the book, but working on it last night, I thought about it, and I didn't think that was the best approach. So instead, what I'm going to do is lay out some of the history that he talks about in the book and go through it as it leads up into this capitalist realist framework he talks about, and kind of go from there, because without the history, I could talk about the book, but it would not be as impactful. So the beginning of the end of the old way of doing things was in October 1978, Jimmy Carter signed the Airline Deregulation Act into law, and that completely deregulated the airlines from all forms of government regulation. And that was the first major step that any government had taken up to that point of rolling back deregulations that had been in place for decades at that point. So that kind of marked the beginning of that period of neoliberalism. And then he talks about the day things ended was Saturday, October 6, 1979. And during that day, the Fed raised the interest rates to about 20%, and they did other programs as well that kind of marked the shift fully away from this Fordist workplace where you're very constrained, but there was a clear delineation between work and your personal life. So you'd go in the factory, you would work, and you'd come back. But then after this kind of marks the period where work and life become intertwined to the extent where you can't really escape one when you're at the other, and vice versa. And this was accelerated in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, and is kind of epitomized through this famous quote from the movie Wall Street. Gordon Gekko, who's played by Michael Douglas, has this quote when he's speaking to these stockbrokers. He said, "Greed, for lack of a better word, is good." And this decade was kind of defined by deregulation and privatization and like the ethos of Wall Street, and how kind of just looking out for yourself was like the overriding philosophy for a lot of people. That was like preached in multiple, through multiple sources. I should also add on, during this era, you saw just the complete breakdown and destruction of any kind of form of genuine alternative feedback against these groups. So like, perfect example would be Ronald Reagan. He broke the airline controller strike by firing them all, and that kind of showed that the government could just sweep away organized labor if it just wanted to, with literally just a declaration. So Francis Fukuyama in 1992 published a book called The End of History and the Last Man, and in that, he didn't come up with this idea, but he kind of made it famous, where the end of history is this concept that supposes that there is this point at which there's this political, economic, and social system whereby there is no more development. Like, once we reach that point, things have stopped, and the only thing you can do is kind of work within that system and reform it. And this was typified when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991 and liberal democracy and markets became the only game in town, and there was no seeming alternative at that point. It seemed that the control societies had collapsed and organized labor had completely been neutered and rendered ineffective. And then Margaret Thatcher had this famous quote when she was speaking to this group of conservatives at a conference, where she said there's no alternative to what's going on now. She said, maybe there should be, maybe it would be nice if there was, but we've seen what the alternatives are. And it became like this phrase that people kind of just implicitly got ingrained into their minds. And so now we finally get to the point where this capitalist realism kind of almost ideology takes hold. And I'm just going to read this here. So Fisher was saying that, and again, Fisher didn't come up with this idea, but he kind of reintroduced it and made it more contemporary. So capitalist realism is the notion that capitalism permeates more than just the economic realm. It constrains and delimits our scope of thought to such an extent that it is easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. So even in a world devastated by ecological disaster and horrendous levels of income and wealth inequality, capitalism still dominates while the masses suffer. And this is kind of exemplified in cyberpunk literature. This series of images is from the movie Blade Runner 2049, which came out 6 years ago. It's a really good movie, but in this movie, there's all these horrible things that are happening, but people are still living in it and just accepting it. Like an example, the image in the upper left corner is Las Vegas, but it's been completely just wiped out by climate change, and so it's not just this barren orange desert. And people are still living in this world. They're really just surviving, they're not living. And how it's become easier to imagine this kind of world than a world in which this dystopia doesn't exist. And then besides that, another thing Fisher brings up in his book is that these alternatives that are brought up, that are talked about, are devoid of any meaning. So as an example, he doesn't bring this example up, but he does mention something similar to it, where 100 years ago, there was literally violent radical wars that went on between coal miners and the bosses of coal mines, and how literally there was this warfare between them. And so during the Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921 in West Virginia, the bosses of the coal mines literally dropped bombs on their workers, and that's what this image is. It's literally a bomb they were gonna drop on their workers, or they had set up like almost like car bombs to bomb the union leaders and stuff to kill off the workers. And Fisher talks about in the book how many things that seemingly are anti-capitalist or more progressive and revolutionary have become more conservative over time and have kind of lost their bite. And so, whereas maybe 100 years ago, people were pushing this kind of notion of an alternative society to capitalism, both economically and socially, a lot of anti-capitalist movements or seemingly progressive individuals have kind of gone away from that notion to a notion of just mitigating its negative effects. So you can see how the capitalist realist framework fills into that void by kind of making these groups that seemingly are for reform, that are seemingly for revolution and helping out, helping to open people's eyes to an alternative system, have really just kind of accepted the system as is and are just kind of trying to work around the edges. And how that's not really helpful, because if the system is still in place, you can reform it as much as you want, but in Fisher's mind, if you don't change the system fundamentally, things are never going to really change. And as this book came out during this Great Recession, he talks about how he brings up the great idea that Martin Luther King Jr. made famous, that there's socialism for the rich and rugged individualism for the poor, and how when the banks destroyed the economy and brought everything to the brink of collapse 15 years ago, how these supposedly free market fundamentalists were too ready to bail out the banks because they knew that if they didn't, the whole world economy would collapse and that would be the end of capitalism potentially, or the end of what they were comfortable with. So there's a bit of hypocrisy, he points out, between these people's ideas of a fundamentally free market and then, you know, government welfare for these corporations that literally wreck the world. And one of Fisher's most interesting points near the end of the book is how, kind of playing off this last one, there's this notion that's preached of moral responsibility for individuals, but corporations, because they're not really people, they can't do anything wrong, so you can never punish one. And so he talks about mental health and education and healthcare in the book as examples of things that have become so atomized and individualized that we've come to blame people for drug abuse or suicide or depression or mental illnesses. And rather than looking at the society that those people are living in, we've just come to understand that these individuals, there's something wrong with them at a human level, and the system is not to blame for any of these issues. And the great example he kind of gives of this kind of frustration and this atomization of individual responsibility is when you have a call center, you have a problem you want to address, and it's to your insurance agency or your healthcare agency, but you can't actually get to the problem. You have to be on hold for minutes, and you're talking to somebody, and then they can maybe help you address the issue, but then the fundamental thing that's causing this is not changed, and you grow frustrated, you go irritated, and you just want to scream and yell at somebody because it's so frustrating and upsetting. But you said you typically don't do that because you understand that the individual you're talking to has no power, and even if they did, there's not enough power to change it. And so how we become so frustrated and upset at these things that are impersonal in a lot of ways. And then at last, I have come to the connections I drew after reading this book to the fifth principle. So the fifth principle for Unitarian Universalism is the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large. I kind of split my thoughts into the right of conscience and then use of the democratic process. So when I was thinking about this book and what it offers and what Unitarian Universalism offers to people and what it's offered to me in my year of coming here, I've thought about this. And in my opinion, for the first part, so the right of conscience, Unitarian Universalism stresses that its adherents think for themselves and not follow any set creed or dogma. So obviously we have these principles we kind of strive towards, but they're more guidelines than like set rules. And we're allowed to interpret those how we want. So through that kind of free thinking that Unitarian Universalism promotes, they can kind of help us thin the veil that's been thrown over us by capitalist realism for the better part of 50 years. And so through encouraging a set of free-thinking, critical-thinking individuals, Unitarian Universalism kind of can help us kind of break out of this sleepwalk that we've been going through, that we've been enmeshed in without even knowing it. And then with this, Unitarian Universalism can serve as a staging ground for kind of a discussion of a radical politics and a discussion of thoughts considered like uncouth in polite society. And through this, we can strive to make the world a better place by advocating for real, like actual structural change that's not just surface level kind of identitarian ideas. And then to conclude, there's this great quote from this video game, Assassin's Creed 2. And the main character, Ezio, he gives this speech during one of the levels after, essentially the context for this is this dictator is basically trying to take over the city and he stopped the dictator, but then the people are still might riot because they saw this dictator as almost like a godlike figure. And so he gives this speech to the crowd, and I think it really encapsulates what Fisher was trying to do in his book, which is kind of wake people up and shake people up and reveal this system that you're living in they don't even know, and then also what Unitarian Universalism offers through its promotion of kind of free critical thinking. So to read this in full, he's saying, "My friends and mentors never preached answers, but guided me to learn from and for myself. We do not need anyone to tell us what to do. We are free to follow our own path. There are those who will take that freedom from us, and too many of you gladly give it. But it is our ability to choose, whatever you think is true, that makes us human. There is no book or teacher to give you the answers, to show you the path. Choose your own way. Do not follow me or anyone else."
Hymn number 120.